The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made a start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in tonight. And a couple of quick announcements before we start. One is that this is going to be the 60-minute format show. So if you do have comments or questions and you want to do it by email or our toll-free line, please watch the clock so that you can get it in before we end. And then in keeping with our week of being very sad for the loss of Dr. Paul Spuda, this program is also in his memory. And the Space Show really misses Paul a lot. He was with us for, I think, 22 programs. And I was hoping to get more in 2018, but he told me he didn't feel well enough to do it, and now we know why. So we think about Paul a lot, so... Anyway, just wanted to get that out there. But we do have an exciting show, and one of our favorite guests, Dr. Pat Hines, is with us. And we are going to be talking about the Spaceflight Conference Symposium coming up in New Mexico in about a month. Actually, today, just a little over a month, the International Symposium for Personal and Commercial Spaceflight. First, a couple of very quick announcements. Our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. And do remember, there's no call screeners, and be patient, let it ring, and I'll bring you up on air just as quickly as I possibly can. Also, do remember, you can use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can post a comment on our blog, which is off of our website. If you need instructions on doing that, please send me an email at the drspace@thespaceshow.com address. Check out our newsletter, our website newsletter. It is posted on our homepage, and it's over toward the right side. Make sure you scroll down to see the programming we're scheduling between now and the end of the year. And your guest suggestions are always welcome. Send them to us by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. A couple of other things that I just want to point out very quickly is that the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit with onegiantleapfoundation.org. Your support keeps us on the air. So on our homepage, you will find information about supporting the Space Show using PayPal, or if you prefer, using a check, how to address the check and who to send it to. And as a 501c3 nonprofit, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction. And if you're in California and you pay California taxes, you also get a tax deduction for your gift. So if you have any questions, visit our parent, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download and circulate and pass around our programs, though it's much easier to just send people the URL for the show. And if you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to let me know. There are a couple of rules, so don't do anything commercial with the programs. Don't edit or clip them. Put things up on YouTube or any other channel or website. And if you do have special needs or requests, email me, please, and ask me, and let's see if we can work things out. Also, written transcripts are not permitted, even if it's for your own purposes. And our full copyright statement is at the bottom of all of our website pages, as well as the website pages for onegiantleapfoundation.org. Podcasting is with gigadial.net. We're in iTunes and a lot of other places, including Alexa, as well as on the TuneIn player, which is also embedded on our website, under Listen Now, which is in the upper left menu. That menu item does tell you how to listen to archive shows, podcasting shows, Alexa shows, and live shows. Feel free to share that information. So we do have sponsors, and this is a shorter program, so I don't read the sponsor messages, but I do want to thank our sponsors. And remember, sponsors do get a banner ad going across our website homepage that they can change as often as they want. But we do thank Northrop Grumman, AIAA, Celestis, the Space Development Network, the National Space Society, Integrated Space Systems and Networks, and the Space Foundation for their support. And that brings me to our guest, and as I said a few minutes ago, Dr. Pat Hines is with us, and she is the director of the New Mexico Space Grant Consortium, the NASA Experimental Program for Competitive Research. She's also an AIAA fellow. And every year in October, she hosts and put together an incredible event, the International Symposium for Personal and Commercial Spaceflight. And they've been doing that since, I believe, 2005. Pat has her PhD in business administration, and you should read her full bio on the Space Show website. It is up there. We want to talk to Pat. By the way, you can get to the symposium's website. It is I, S as in Sam, P as in Peter, C, S as in Sam, .com. And you can follow along to the degree that we parallel the website. Pat, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you, David. I'm fine, thank you. And I got caught up on Pepper, the dog, and I'm sure your audience knows a bit about Pepper.
Yeah, she often will come in with squeaky toys and try to get me to play with her while I'm doing the show. So I've had guests say, what's that squeaking noise that they hear? So, but in the hot weather, she doesn't come up here upstairs that often because it's pretty hot upstairs, and she wears a fur coat all the time.
All day. And y'all don't have air conditioning out there?
The place that I'm renting does have air conditioning, but they were sold a con job, if you ask me, by the architect and the contractor and the developer. It isn't worth anything. And it doesn't do anything upstairs. But if you're downstairs in one room in front of the vents, it's moderately successful. But, you know, I bought these little $20 coolers I saw on an infomercial on TV
yeah.
that you fill with water. And they're about the size of a box that a basketball would come in.
Okay.
So I fill it with water. It'll run for 12 hours.
Ooh.
And I stick it on my desk. It's electric. It's very quiet. And it cools about 30 square feet right in front of you, kind of the personal space you fill up depending
oh
on how
goodness.
Fat you are. And it's really great. And I put it on a nightstand at night, and it cools the area where I sleep. And it does a very effective job, and it's quiet. And it hardly uses any electricity, which is important in California.
Oh, my goodness, that's great.
And I forget the name of it. I think it's called Arctic Cooler, but they run infomercials with it. And normally I wouldn't buy an infomercial product, but what the hell for $20 and $40 for two of them, I decided
oh, yeah.
to try it. And I've had them all summer, and they haven't broken yet. So,
well, hallelujah.
So it's better than, in a way, better than air conditioning. Maybe I can take them to Mars with me if the cooling system is bad in the spaceflight cabin. I don't know.
Well, plan ahead. It's always good to plan ahead.
And it doesn't weigh much, so it wouldn't contribute much to taking mass on board the spacecraft.
Well, I'll leave that case to you.
So you have a theme for this year's event called the tipping point. So let's
yes.
start with what is the tipping point representative of?
Well, when I first was able to get my arms around this idea that I've noticed trends all my life, I read Malcolm Gladwell's book, and now it's 20-some-odd years old, called The Tipping Point. And Gladwell was talking about things like fashion trends. How does a trend become a trend, and is there a way to see these kinds of trends coming And then, are there variables that are salient consistently to tell you, well, we could be approaching a tipping point? So I'm going to say something before I get deep into the conversation of tipping point. I'm an associate fellow of the AIAA. Just wanted to, before I got lost on that one. So probably what happened as I started noticing trends in the commercial space industry, it started happening with the 2010 space policy, and I'm focusing a lot on policy this year for a reason, because of the space policy directives 1, 2, and 3. But in 2010, when Obama put into the space policy, essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, that if a commercial capability exists, the government will not compete against it, and in fact will, if it needs that technology, acquire it. That became a tipping point for our industry, and to the point where it enabled Elon Musk, for example, who always said the reason he brought his company to the United States was because of the rule of law. It enabled Elon Musk to finally break the monopoly, for good or ill, that ULA had on Air Force launches. And so he had to sue the Air Force to get the right to be able to bid on some Air Force satellite launch contracts. So that began, or the way I felt that was a tipping point, was when Elon won, it became very clear there was a change in the way some of the large heritage space companies were going to have to think about procurement. Now, this time in our industry sound familiar to you?
Yeah, it seems to be. I think we repeat things from time to time. But yeah, it does sound familiar, but I think progress is too slow, of course. But
well, it was on one company. You know, there's Elon trying to get his company started.
Yeah, and he's got a monopoly for sure.
Who has a monopoly?
What he's going against, ULA.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying ULA intentionally established themselves as a monopoly, but when they were put together as United Launch Alliance, Boeing and Lockheed Martin, what was happening at the time was to try and preserve the launch industry in our country. And Elon, I don't want to say single-handedly, because in fact he was helped by NASA tremendously, to get through his infant mortality phase and become a viable launch provider and a competitor to not just ULA, but also to Ariane Space. And as we saw the recognition that, oh man, this is changing the environment where access to space is going to become competitive. And in the meantime, we've got Dave Thompson, who's one of the most brilliant men we have in the industry out there, developing Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport, becoming then one of the CRS providers, along with SpaceX and with Boeing. Eventually Sierra Nevada Corporation. We've got a tipping point in terms of access to space. Now, that's on the cargo side. And what that's also done is change something else in the launch industry, and that is when Elon started with the Falcon 1 that you were just talking about, there wasn't a market for the Falcon 1. And Gwen has often said, you know, we tried and the market wasn't there. But in fact, the access to space provided by NASA and the ability for companies like NanoRacks to put a platform eventually on ISS. Now we have the Missy platform. Also the evolution with CASIS, and they're starting to sort of figure out how to be of assistance to enable more demand for ISS and also more demand for access the space for the small satellites and the CubeSats. All of this started in 2010 with a space policy directive, as well as the closing of the shuttle program, the development of organizations like Space Florida, who just dug in and said, we are going to dominate. We are not going to let go of our space heritage. And they just created a hub out there at Florida Spaceport on the Cape, you know, near Kennedy Space Center. And all of these things began to create a tipping point. All of this increased access to space, the increased competitiveness, the support of the federal government for the innovation and the tolerance of risk that it took in this environment got us to where we now have President Trump aligning the federal government to even enable more ease of access for the user community. So what I mean by tipping point is it started very slowly and it wasn't expected by the general public, but I believe there are visionaries at NASA, including Bill Gerstenmaier, people like Steve Jurczyk, one of our speakers, Tom Crimmins, and many, many others, Alex McDonald's there, and the guys in Flight Opportunities. All these folks at the Cape were working to not just keep the patient alive, the space industry in Florida. I mean, we intervening, we had the recession as well. But there's a passion for our industry, and it just began to coalesce once we let go of shuttle, which was very painful. We grabbed on to an entire industry now that has enabled students, young people, to invest their careers. That's another tipping point. How many young people?
What about a tipping point for human spaceflight? Are you seeing that?
Yes, that's coming too. But what I will say in terms of the investment that, you know, people who have made careers at not just SpaceX, not just Blue Origin, but at Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, people who are changing their lives because they decided, I'm going to invest my career in space. I'm going to move to where I need to go. So they also see human spaceflight as something that's possible for them in their future, that they can work on these human spaceflight programs. And that's happening right now. And it wasn't happening like this 5 years ago even. So when I decided that explaining the story of the tipping point would be the focus of ISTCS this year, I have people like Dan Rasky speaking, another visionary. And you know Rasky, don't you?
Correct. Yes, I do know him.
And here's a guy who had the vision for a gateway to space, a portal to space, that needed to happen, and it needed to happen at Ames, because he believed it was also an incubator for innovation. Ames has been. They're close to Silicon Valley, and for years, Dan and his team just kind of limped along until it became clear that they have technologies that are very useful for people like Elon again, the TPS system. That Elon, did you hear the story? Have you ever heard Dan's story? He had 12 tutorials online, and Alan Lockheed Jr. said, "Pat, you know, have you watched these things? You really need to go watch these things." And Dan told the story in his own words, how he became involved with SpaceX. And I went to Hawthorne when they had just moved in. There was a ping pong table in the middle of the floor. My favorite thing was the kitchen. But, you know, there was really nothing on the floor yet. And that's when Dan got first visited Elon, because Elon called him and asked him if he'd, he wanted to go to Mars, and Dan's reentry thermal protection system on, I believe it was the Mars probe, and Elon saw the reentry video and called Dan and said, "I need you. Can you come visit me?" And Dan did, and that started a whole relationship with NASA that preceded him applying for the TRS program. And when he spoke at ISPCS, when Elon spoke at ISPCS in 2007, he was going from ISPCS to Houston to work on his proposal, and he lost that round to Kistler rocket plane. And when Kistler didn't make it, Elon was then their third choice. So as in following the industry through ISPCS, it's a great historic site for also just for all the archives and all the presentations we've archived for the last 14 years. On essentially the start of the industry with the winning of the XPRIZE Cup in 2004.
Goes back to probably before 2004, too. There were grandiose plans for that companies were funding and working on funding. A lot of them were detailed in my dissertation back in the late 90s.
Yep.
They didn't make it, but they inspired a whole set of generations, I would think.
Well, they inspired ISPCS. You remember Bill Gobitz, right?
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Absolutely. Another great one that we lost.
Yes, and Bill was co-founder with me of ISPCS. And we were working in the 90s. I met him through the Delta Clipper program. So we started working on speaking at conferences about, for example, what Virgin is doing and Blue is doing, airline-style operations that they were hoping for with the Delta Clipper program. So all of this, I think I've talked about it on the show before, but now, fast-forwarding to right now, what I was pointing out when Obama just had that one policy direct, space policy that he released in 2010, now President Trump's administration has released three policy directives, and I was talking with Tom Crimmins, and he's the associate administrator for space policy and strategic directives at NASA, as well as the acting chief of staff. He was saying that now we're actually probably going to make it, having the White House behind him and having moved much farther ahead in technology development that we didn't have in 2007, 2010. Reusability is another tipping point that we could talk about for inland spaceports later, but just this idea that this time it's likely that we're going to actually return to the moon. Whether we do it in President Trump's administration is a question, but it seems like the persistence by the companies, because it matters to their bottom line, it's not that they're trying to please their government customer. It's that their stockholders and their investors have expectations and goals for them to meet. And that's a different energy. And it's the difference between being an entrepreneur and working for the federal government. Elon Musk, you've heard the stories about, you know, if he goes and looks in the parking lot on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and if he doesn't see a lot of cars in it, he just thinks there's a lack of motivation here. And he expects more, and he gets more. And I'm not saying that's just Elon. I have the same thing. You know, I expect my staff to work more than they're expected to work and harder than they're expected to work, and they deliver. So that's their call. They don't have to, but I expect it, and I get it. So that's part of that entrepreneurial spirit. And one more thing, too, David. I retired from Space Grant and NASA ESCORT a month ago.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. Congratulations, I guess. assuming you wanted to retire.
Oh, gosh. 30 years, yes. But, you know, I'm still working. Here it is, 8 o'clock at night. We're talking. And we did give 5 minutes to the dog. But, you know, this is work. And I have my research right here because I wanted to talk to the... You were talking about human space flight, and I have this wonderful article about the Kármán line and what is the definition, or what are the considerations, technical considerations, historic considerations, for choosing the boundaries for space as we define it. And nowhere in this article, this is more of a technical article, but nowhere in this article is it stated that it's a marketing tool as well. You know, there's a lot of the Virgin Galactic customers, they want to be called astronauts.
Right.
Not, I don't know how else to say it, but the way this article goes all the way back, you know, to the X-15 program, the SR-71, the definition that indicate you have left the atmosphere is when the control surfaces on an aircraft no longer respond. Well, you've left the atmosphere, but it depends on where you are as to what your altitude is. So there is not a fixed definition if you use that definition, for example. So in terms of marketing, for the companies like Blue and Birchin, it used to be 100 kilometers, you know, now 62 miles. Well, I don't think Virgin's going to do that. I don't know. That's for them to say. But at this stage in the industry, we have a new variable that matters, and that is the marketplace. What does the consumer say they want? And so as we look at the space policy directives, what we're discovering is that the voices are pretty loud about the regulatory environment is prohibiting, and you know, that's, you can hear that cry all day and all night in the marketplace, but for the space industry, since I started doing ISPCS, in human spaceflight, there was concern that NASA's very prescriptive standards and requirements were going to translate over whole cloth into requirements for human spaceflight for commercial providers. That hasn't happened. And what's happened has been that SpaceX and Boeing have had a much more collaborative relationship with NASA to help NASA understand, and you know what, that's really going to be expensive, you know, whatever they're, I'm not going to be specific here, and we're going to do it this way, we're going to run through the test programs, you guys, of course, will be involved in every step of the way, and possibly you'll see that we don't need blank. So that's been going on for years regarding human spaceflight. And so we will see how competitive prices are, because the only price out there right now is the Russians. And I think we, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there have been any space tourists on station.
Not for, I think, a couple of years.
Oh, much longer.
Or maybe longer. Time seems to fly.
Simignone, I think, was one of the last, if not the last. But, it, you know, I apologize to the audience. I might be a couple of tourists off there. But I would say it's, well,
it's been a number of years. There hasn't been a seat available for tourists.
Yeah, because we bought, I believe, all the available space. Now, Gerstenmaier was coming to ISPCS, and Mr. Bridenstine's office as well was very interested in him making it, but this is the second to last Soyuz launch is happening on October 11th. And when his office said, you know, that if the schedule slips, then, you know, we can revisit this. And I wrote back and I said, they don't slip. And that's part of another thing that is very important in the marketplace is if you have a scheduled launch and you are very consistent in meeting your schedule, that's a competitive edge. And certainly the on-time record for airlines is an important factor. And the business traveler, I was, you know, Paolo, the guy who took over for me. I brought him on a year and a half ago, and I've known him for about 10 years. He was involved in our student launch project. He has been on 4 trips in the last month. Which are trips I always had to go on. I haven't had to travel in a whole month. It's great.
You can get a dog now.
Well, okay, well, I'm just going to hold steady here for the moment. I'm dealing enough with the wildlife that lives in my neighborhood. I had a bobcat in my yard the other day, and this is enough.
Pat, how do you translate the tipping point into the programming of this year's symposium?
Well, there's four segments to ISPCS, day one morning, day one afternoon. So the tipping point discussion around space policy directives 1, 2, and 3, and then the impact on industry will occur on the morning of day one. So we have Tom Crimmins, Kelvin Coleman, who is replacing George Neald. Of course, we all know nobody could replace George, and George brought Kelvin in. So George has great confidence in Kelvin, and we're very happy to have him. I've known him for many years. So he is the acting associate administrator of FAA AST. Kelvin's going to be talking about Space Policy Directive 2, in particular, streamlining of launch and reentry regulations into performance-based regulations, and he's going to be talking about very specific parts of the FAA regulatory environment. And so that, I'm going to get right to parts 415, 417, part 431, and part 435 in particular. And then Eric Stommer, who is the president of the Commercial Space Flight Federation, will also be giving the perspective of his organization, and Eric is also on the user community, a member of the user community group. And then at the last speakers of the day, Francesca Schroeder, who's an attorney, and launch providers and satellite operators are her major client base. And I asked Francesca to bring a panel together of the launch operators to talk about how this regulatory environment will impact them and what they want, so that the people from industry can be, and the people from the agencies who are in the room can hear directly from the attorneys from United Launch Alliance, SpaceX, and Blue Origin. What do they want? And what do they think some of this regulatory change will mean to them? Now, one of the things that's been a disappointment is I could not get anybody from the Office of Space at newly established Office of Space at the Department of Commerce, and I could not get anybody to return a call or an email request in the Department of Commerce. So, as we all know, the Office of Space has 4 people, and Kevin O'Connell has just been put in office. So, Kevin, I reached out to him on LinkedIn. God bless him. He wrote me back. But I never could get anything more established with Kevin, but you got to give the guy a break. He's only been in the office now 2 weeks. So I'll give him some grace. But we do need Department of Commerce to engage, and there's a wonderful paper out by the Aerospace Corporation that was in the Milset magazine on policy primer for small satellites. But in that paper, they talked about, it's a very, very cool little diagram on this government central gateway for small satellite people. And I highly recommend that article. And if you'd like, all the research I'm talking about tonight, David, I can send you the links, and we can put them on your website if you like.
Yeah, please do, and I'll either put them in with the archives or right after I archive the show, I'll post them on the blog.
Great, okay.
So, yeah, please send me whatever material you want, and I'll place it up there.
Yeah, the research on the boundaries of space and the various discussion. Brian Whedon with Secure World Foundation did a great job in editing this, too, and they're going to be speaking. But one of the things that has been necessary for having the story told about the tipping point is to really focus the dialogue during ISPCS so we're not jumping all over the place. So people can really, speaker after speaker can build on the dialogue that's in the morning of day one, just about space policy and the impact on industry at this time. And we film in high definition, so all of these talks will be on our YouTube channel. Our YouTube channel has over 1.5 million viewing minutes and, 600,000 or 700,000 unique views on it. So ISPCS on the YouTube channel, you can see all the talks that we've had at ISPCS since 2012, and all these talks will be on our website too. Probably takes us about a month to edit all of the talks. There's 27 speakers, I think. So then in the afternoon we're going to take a break and do a little science. And after, you know, this policy stuff, and it's sort of like trying to walk through mud. It's just such a difficult environment to get certainty out of. Then we have Stephen Clark, Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration and Science Mission Director at NASA, and then right following him, Victor Luo, who is going to be talking about augmented space exploration. And this is a kind of a virtual reality and augmented reality presentation to help us understand how to put ourselves in the environment, what we're trying to do with the exploration roadmap, and have a total break from the uncertainties of the political environment to get, not that I'm saying that exploration is a certainty, but just changing gears totally in the afternoon, but still having a focus on what is it that the exploration agenda has gotten because of increased capabilities from commercial providers and from the international partners. This is another part of the tipping point, that in our industry, these are tipping points within tipping points that help us, each one of us, grow faster. And the things about tipping points is you need a maven. You need somebody who's a connector to make things happen. And in our case, with NASA, it's been, for me, Bill Gerstenmaier. Bill Gerstenmaier's been a contiguous force. Tom Cremins has been around, again, a force for continuity. And now Steve Jurczyk, again, the Space Technology Mission Director, now he's Deputy Director at NASA. What we have is these mavens and connectors who've been advocates strenuously working towards enabling technologies to be competitive and enabling technologies to meet milestones that are going to get us where we need to go and staying the course. So these are things that have created this momentum that a tipping point will create. And then getting into another part of the environment that has yet to be engaged in a tipping point, and that's academia. So the have you ever heard this, that the triumvirate is what has always kept the space industry strong?
No, I've actually not heard that before.
Government, industry, and academia. That's been around since, you know, development of the ICBM. And Benny Schriever, always advocating, President Eisenhower, always advocating for the triumvirate. It had to be always government, industry, and academia. Academia was critical in the start of the space industry, and academia has been lagging. So what I decided was this year is to focus on, and this is the second part of the day, of day one in the afternoon, is begin to focus on those universities that have taken the opportunity to create programs specifically to support space entrepreneurship and programs that are focused on commercial technology development. So we're starting with Greg Autry at UCSD, and he's there's an entrepreneurship, space entrepreneurship program at UCSD, and he's a professor in that department. So he's going to be talking about how the COTS program and CRS partners have created a whole new ecosystem, and how his students are taking advantage of being in proximity to some of the new space startups, and how that has impacted their university to continue to invest. And let me see here, the next one, I just want to make sure I'm not skipping somebody. Michael Provenzano, and let me just make sure, yeah. And also, another thing that Greg's going to talk about is public-private partnerships, which is something NASA's been advocating and funding as well. Now, in terms of funding public-private partnerships, there's a lot of it that is unfunded, but NASA's been an advocate for these partnerships as another way of expanding this commercial approach to space access into the marketplace and into the lives of consumers. So then Michael Provenzano is a student. He just graduated with a master's degree from Carnegie Mellon, and he has been involved in developing and funding a Mars rover project, a Cube rover with Astrobotic. And so he'll be speaking. He's going to do a spotlight talk. And then I have Frank DeMauro with Northrop Grumman Innovative Systems. And Frank is, wait a second, I've got, yeah, well, actually, Frank is speaking after Mark Gittleman with the MISSI program. And so then Frank DeMauro is going to be talking about satellite servicing, and he is a vice president and general manager of advanced programs at now Northrop Grumman Innovative Services. And then we're going to have Tim Chen, who's the new program director of NASA Flight Opportunities, talking about his goals for NASA Flight Opportunities, and this program alone has provided a pathway and a gateway for students and faculty at universities very successfully over the last 6 years. And then Tim is out there at Ames, as well as Dan Raske. And Dan is closing the day, day one, and Dan's going to be talking about why the space portal was formed and how at Ames Research Park in the same year ISPCS was founded. And what they're, now poor Dan, he's been working on this like I have for 14 years, providing a friendly front door to the space community. And that article I was telling you about by the Aerospace Corporation, government central gateway, the front door to working with the government, so you kind of have this one-stop shop if you're a satellite, whether you're imaging satellite or communications satellite, should be able to get a single license and work with one agency in one area of Department of Commerce, and that's the Office of Space. So Dan's been working on that since 2005. So I have gotten to day one, and we are just 5 minutes for the end of the show, David. So the second day, my suggestion is I can blast through it or just suggest people go to ispcs.com. George Whiteside is our first speaker, president of Virgin Galactic and the spaceship company. And George has a lot to talk about. Have you seen... There's another article that was done by the New Yorker.
Yeah, I have that. I saw that when I was at the Mars Society gig last week.
What did you think of the article?
I thought it was a good article. A lot of people were talking about it, and it was being circulated.
Yes, and it was very well written, well researched, and most importantly, it closed that credibility gap. You know, because Mike Moses and Stuckey and the flight team, they've done a remarkable job since the accident of completely reconfiguring not only what they're doing, but how they're doing it. And the cohesion within the company is extraordinary. It's really wonderful. It was a very wise move of Richard Branson, another visionary, and his team to take over the manufacturing of the spaceship so that and bring on people like Mike Moses. So, and Stuckey and the astronaut corps. This article in particular focused on Stuckey. Stuckey is just a great story. I had lunch with him when I was at a Virgin Galactic event. And he's not a big man. He's a Buzz Aldrin size guy, but not quite as heavy as Buzz. But intense. Very intense. So, he's not a chatty fellow at all. So, then we have another really interesting person, Brian Barnett. He's flown twice with Blue Origin. He originally, the first time he flew was with me out at Spaceport America in 2012. He has a technology that he's been perfecting, first commercial Wi-Fi service. And what he's got a website, and I can give you the access to the website, but a lot of the stuff that Brian is doing is on his website, and both times he's flown with Blue, his technology worked. And for future payloaders to have real-time data both down and back is something that's been needed for a long time. Now, granted, the TDRS allows that, but the astronauts, NASA Communications has first priority. So if you're a payloader, you may or may not get your data within a day, and it's just the way the government works. They have priority on TDRS. So this is a New Mexican that is doing remarkable things. And then what you can see on day two, we get into technologies and launch providers and the other thing that Tom Kremenz mentioned that we're going to also cover with Secure World Foundation is the international perspective. We're looking, as we develop these space policies, that we look and keep in mind international law. And in order to evolve in a sustainable ecosystem, what Ian Christensen with Secure World Foundation is doing is he's just updating the group on some of his work with MCOPAS, the UN Committee on Outer Space, and we've been very fortunate to have a relationship with Secure World Foundation for many years, and they're looking to sustain the peaceful use of space and long-term viability of a sustainable space industry. So then we have that academia focus comes back again as we get into two other discussions. Harvard Business School is also developing a program in commercial space, and they have been evolving this program. Ariane Cornell, who is our master moderator for day two, as you know, probably is a, you probably know she's a graduate of Harvard Business School, and she works as business development officer for Blue for New Shepard. And then my former boss at NASA, Joletta Patrick, who's the program manager for Space Grant NASA EBSCOR, is going to be chairing a panel, and she's a former flight director that decided to switch her career at NASA and get more into the education arena because she felt like she could make the greatest difference there, running the Space Grant and the NASA EBSCOR program and the minority, the MURIP, minority and underrepresented programs at NASA. And she is chairing a panel with Andy Aldrin, who is establishing in collaboration with the International Space University and Florida Institute of Technology a Center for Space Entrepreneurship at FIT. And so Andy is going to be talking about that. George Sowers, did you ever meet George?
Yeah, he's been on the show many times. He's over in Colorado now.
Yep, and he is at Colorado School of Mines.
Right.
And they recruited him to work in their space resource mining area. Another commitment by a university to develop a very relevant technology focus at Colorado School of Mines. And then finally, we're going to have Dan Dunbacher. And Dan, has Dan been on the show lately?
Yes, when he took over AIAA, he was on the show.
Now, yep, prior to going to AIAA, he was at Purdue. They recruited him to, again, the three things these folks have in common is they were former government contractors who worked in the space industry or worked with NASA, left NASA because they knew academia really needed to get more focused on the space industry. They weren't keeping up. So these three discussions, Dan is going to be talking not only about his time at Purdue, but also the impact he can make because he's now the executive director of AIAA. So this focus here is to talk about what's succeeding, why these guys went back into academia, and how it's going. And so we have actually five speakers from academia talking about successful commitments and investments by their universities in the space industry as it is now, the commercial space industry. Then following that, right up, Jeff Manber, who got his start with Kentucky Space Grant, and who services a tremendous user community that many of them started as students who were getting ready to fly their CubeSats. So he's going to be speaking, and NanoRacks has done some remarkable things, and the story of persistence with Jeff is just amazing what it's taken for him to get his project started. And then finally, another story of tremendous persistence is with Dave Ruppel, airport director of Colorado Air and Spaceport, the Front Range. They just got their license. They were an inland spaceport in urban, in Denver. It's a great story of persistence. And Sierra Nevada Corporation would be, Dream Chaser would hopefully be one of their operators they're calling the airport Colorado Air and Spaceport. And then the other speaker is going to be, this is another kind of tipping point in our industry, these inland spaceports. Now we have 11 FAA licensed spaceports. And we have a proliferation of urban spaceports, those spaceports that are pretty much in highly populated areas. Ellington Field in Houston, Arturo Machuco, is a general manager of Ellington Airport and Houston Airport System. And so they call the Ellington Airport, Houston, and Ellington Airport System. So they call it Airport System. So those two guys are going to be talking about what it's like and what are their concept of operation and what is their business model for operating in an urban environment. And this is new, but there are Mojave Air and Spaceport is kind of this hybrid air and spaceport, general aviation and spaceport. You have Cecil Field, Midland, now Denver or Colorado Air and Spaceport, and then Ellington Field. So these ground facilities are also starting to move forward in the industry as well, and we're looking forward to those talks. And then we have Ben Fang chairing the commercial resupply panel with Northrop Grumman Innovative Systems. And now Bob Richards is going to represent Northrop. Benji Reed with SpaceX. And Steve Lindsay, Vice President for Space Exploration, former astronaut with Sierra Nevada Corporation. And our final panel of the day is Kathy Leaders. And she is a graduate of NMSU with John Mulholland, Senior Vice President and Program Manager for Commercial Programs at Boeing Company, also a graduate of NMSU. And again, Benji Reed is going to speak on behalf of SpaceX. And by then, we're done. 2 minutes over.
What do you have for networking, meeting all of these people, events, get-togethers? How is that for this year's symposium?
Well, we have a golf day on Tuesday, October 9th, and this is sponsored by Special Aerospace Services and Lockheed Martin. And those guys, what they do is it's actually personally sponsored by our friends there. And what they do is you register on our website, and I think it's $35, and it's just for green fees and your golf club. And then they just go out and play and come back, and then we go to the speaker and sponsor reception at 5:30, and that's at the Double Eagle restaurant, and that's beautiful restaurant off in Mesilla in New Mexico in Las Cruces. It's a beautiful hotel, and one of our sponsors holds a reception for our speakers and sponsors. Then we have the opening reception at the Conference Hotel in Las Cruces, and that starts at 6:30, and that is essentially dinner, that a stand-up dinner we provide for all of our out-of-town guests. It's like the reception when you go into a wedding for the out-of-towners. So we provide that opening reception. That's sponsored by AIAA. They're just absolutely marvelous sponsors, AIAA is. And then we start each day of the conference at 5:30 with a run, and you'd be amazed to see who goes on that run every morning. We also have in parallel on Tuesday, before I get off of Tuesday, is we had the FAA AST Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transportation technical meeting at the Hotel Encanto, and you can register for that meeting on our website as well. There's no charge for that meeting. This is their annual technical meeting, and it's just remarkable what is going on with the universities that are involved in the COECST, and it's getting better and better each year. We have Marie Bajaj, for example, who is discussing his space traffic management research, and there's Mariba is very well known. He's at University of Texas, UT Austin. And that we cover human space flight, propulsion, cover a number of different topics. And so that's October 9th at the Hotel Encanto, and you can register on our website, ispcs.com. The conference is October 10th. As I said, we start out at 5:30 in the morning with a run, and that's a stewarded run, so we take everybody out to the run route, and we have students in front and behind the runners, so we make sure everybody who goes out comes back. And then we have hot breakfast, and we're expecting a good chili harvest this season, so we have breakfast burritos in the morning on Wednesday, and then the hospitality goes on, that we have an industry reception at 5:30 to 7, and then our banquet from 7 to 8:30, and then after hours reception. And then the next day, for those people who did take some of those desserts at the after hours reception, got 5:30 run again, and we do the same thing, and then we end with the Happy Trails beer tasting at the end of Thursday, and then I'm usually totally fried, but ecstatic that I've had such a great time with everybody. And then I have a few folks over to my house just because I get too lonely. I need like a kind of down, you know, a slow release of everybody, and then I'm happy to go to sleep around midnight. So that's the 2 days. It takes a year to put all this together for those 2 days, and there's a lot going on.
Are there still hotel reservations at the Encanto?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
If anybody has any trouble, just call my office, and the phone number's on our website. If you have any trouble at all, the hotel has a block of rooms, and they release the block of rooms, I think, around October 5th. But don't wait, because the early bird rate closes, I think, this Friday. So
okay,
saddle up if you're coming. We'd love to see whoever is listening. Come on. It's a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, this will be up and running for people tomorrow, and send me those links so I can get them up there, too.
I will. I might not get them to you by the time you post it.
Well, then I'll post it on the blog. It's not a... not a big deal. But as soon as I get it from you, I'll put it up on the blog.
Thank you.
Sounds like fun. Are you going to do it another year?
Yeah. I already know what we're doing in 19 as far as my theme goes. My lips are sealed.
So we can't twist it out of you, huh?
No.
Okay. As always, it is exciting and fun and interesting to talk to you, and I look forward to it. And we'll probably get several space show guests from your speakers. So I look forward to doing that as well.
I hope you do, because there's some of the people I mentioned today. Joletta is just a remarkable woman. And Michael Provenzano, this young man, he's investing his entire career in space, and it's one of those great success stories, and Brian Barnett, of course. And then I would just say you'll know who. All of our speakers wouldn't get the stage if they didn't have a story to tell.
Well, many of them have already been on the show many times.
Oh, they have?
Oh, yeah. Greg Autry's been on the show. Maribo, I never can pronounce his name.
Maribo Ja.
Maribo, he was on when he was at the working at the University of Arizona in Tucson.
Yeah.
Before he went to UT.
And he's a former AFRL guy. That's how I first met him.
Dan Rasky, of course. I'd have to go back through the list, but a lot of them have been on the show.
Good. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing this, and I'm always grateful for the time that you devote to our industry, too, David. We have two city councilors that are graduates of the program at North Dakota, and I always tell them about you, and they actually know you. Gil Sorg and I forget his first name. His last name is Eichmann. I funded his daughter, who's an astronomer. She built an instrument on a Magdalena Research Observatory telescope. Jack Eichmann.
I don't know them, but I'm still an adjunct there, although I haven't been back to teach for about 2 years. I hope I can come back. Or they have me teaching now by remote online.
Good.
But I'm ready and willing. Hopefully I can arrange it to come back and teach my commercial space class for the new group of people, because it's changed. It changes so fast, Pat, that what we talked about 2 years ago is not really valid anymore.
Tipping point.
Yeah, tipping point is right.
Rocking. Things are moving quickly.
Very quickly.
Yeah, but predictably, and that's nice. Tipping points don't have to be unpredictable.
And one of the benefits of teaching online, Pepper is in the class with me.
Is she paying attention?
I took her out to look at Mars multiple times when it was really close. She didn't give a damn, but I pointed her head in the direction and kept repeating Mars. So whether any of it sunk through, probably not. But I made the effort. What can I say?
Excellent. Well, that's all you can do, right?
That's all I can do. I will be in touch with you, and thank you so much for being back with us. And when I start inviting people to the show after the symposium, I'll copy you and let you know who I'm asking on the show.
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm very interested and very happy for them.
Okay. We will be in touch, and I'll send you the information when it gets up and running.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. And listeners, we thank you for your support as well. And our next space show program is Friday morning, other than Hotel Mars tomorrow. Thank you all, and goodbye from the space show and Dr. Pat Hines.